This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
Investing is a competitive game. You are in there trying to find the cheap assets, and so is everybody else. You are in there trying to hold more at the right time and less at the wrong time, and so is everybody else. So to some extent, you have to learn to think different from others and better. Thinking different is not enough if it's worse. It has to be different and better. And that is the concept that enables you to find the errors that others are making.
Yes, I think another important principle you have is you need to stay in the game.
Right.
And maybe explain that a little further, because that's kind of a motto of your business.
Well, that's another of the important sayings in the investment business. Never forget about the man who was 6 foot tall, who drowned crossing the stream that was 5 feet deep on average.
I never heard that story.
Well, the point is, to be a successful investor, at minimum, you have to survive. Surviving on the good days is not the issue. You have to be able to survive the bad days. The idea of surviving on average is not sufficient. You have to be able to survive on the worst days.
Super excited to have Howard Marks, head of Oaktree Investment Management. Is that how you say it?
Oaktree Capital Management.
Oaktree Capital Management. It's got $120 billion in assets. It's a combination of all sorts of funds. We'll kind of describe it in a little bit. But also, you just out is your new book, Mastering the Market Cycle, Getting the Odds on Your Side. I have to mention, you're number 374 on the Forbes Most Wealthy list, worth about $1.91 billion. Welcome to the show, Howard Marks.
Thank you very much.
Do you hate that actually being introduced as like a billionaire?
I do, you know.
I apologize.
Well, that's okay. I mean, on the one hand, people want to hear it and it gets you more attention. But on the other hand, they don't say, here's Howard Marks, right-hander, or Howard Marks, tennis player,
right,
or Howard Marks, father of two. And, you know, I don't think that how much money I have sums me up, and I don't think it's the greatest thing about me. So
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because I agree. So, and clearly having multiple billions doesn't make your life any easier or better than, let's say, you had a few million or 10 million,
right,
whatever,
right,
or,
sure,
or even less, depending on how much you loved your job.
Right.
You know, I always think loving what you do and having well-being and contentment is much more about freedom than simply having $1 billion.
There's no question. You know, James, I use a lot of quotes in the book and in my writing, my speaking. And my favorite quote is from a guy named Christopher Morley, an English writer. And he said, there's only one success, to be able to live your life your own way.
Yeah, that's totally true.
It's profound. And, I'm lucky that my job has given me the rewards, the satisfaction that it has.
Yeah, it's like. Well, your buddy Warren Buffett says he skips to work every day.
That's right.
And you know, so actually, this is a tangent to your book. Well, let me ask you about this theory I have. So people say to other people, "Hey, what's your net worth?" Like I just said yours. And sometimes it's a number in the bank. Like, oh, someone has $12 million cash in the bank, $50,000 cash in the bank, and then they have some investments or whatever. But I also think if you love what you do and it's fairly stable, your income stream, which not every income stream is, but if you love what you do and let's say you work for yourself and you have an income stream of, let's say, $200,000 a year, I'm just making the numbers up. If you use what a risk-free return is, let's say it's 4%,
right,
making that up, then you could essentially say your net worth is 25 times the amount of money you make per year that's dependent on what you love doing. So it's kind of like a love net worth, but financially speaking. So that person who's worth makes $200,000 doing exactly what he loves or she loves every day is worth, in some virtual sense, about $5 million.
Right.
It's like a theory I have.
Well, it's a good theory.
All right, good. I'm glad. But you have both sides of it, which is, of course, you've earned a good amount doing what you do, and you love what you do. And your book, which talks both philosophically and historically and practically about market cycles. For a great example being, the early 2000s after the internet bubble burst, we had this stock market and housing market financial boom, which ended in the great financial crisis. You talk a bit about that book and use that example and other examples to describe how practically even the average investor can start to understand what it means at a market top or a market bottom or in the middle, and then how much risk to take in those situations and what kind of assets to invest in. And you've done this very well for yourself successfully over 50 years, or particularly with Oaktree, its average returns per year are 19%, which are phenomenal. And in some of your distressed debt funds, it's in the mid to high 20%, which is really unbelievable. So you've really not only enjoyed what you've done, but speaking about why does someone introduce you based on a number, like how much one's worth or where you are on the Forbes list, it's kind of like you might say, oh, such and such tennis player is ranked number 4 in the world. So it shows, okay, if this guy speaks about tennis, I'm going to listen to him. If this guy's playing a game of tennis and I want to see excellence on tennis as opposed to my kid playing tennis, I'm going to watch this guy. So, that's the reason I mention it. You wrote a book on mastering the market cycles, but you're not, people should listen. You've done this successfully for 50 years, and investing successfully for 50 years does pay off. And, Oaktree, you started in 1975, so there's a lot of interesting things there. All right, was it 1975? 1995. The longevity of your business is also interesting. You've had a lot of consistency in your life, and I think a lot of the philosophy about mastering the market cycles is related to mastering personal cycles too. You call, in this book and in your other book, you call it second level thinking. Understanding, it's almost like the second derivative of where we are in the markets, of where we are in life, like not the ups and downs, but are the ups and downs increasing? Is now the time to change? Like being able to take a step back and understand when change is required.
Right.
And I'll let you talk in a second. I feel like I'm dominating, but I want to sum up your book in some of your quotes. Like every time I hit a new quote, I underlined it and I thought to myself, that really sums up this book. But then I hit another quote later on. But basically the idea is a market cycle can also be described as like a pendulum. And so when the pendulum is moving in one direction, more and more energy is going into it, pushing it more and more in that direction until finally there's no more energy left. And then just when things seem like it's going to go on forever, the pendulum might even go all the way around, boom, there's no more energy and it goes all the way back down to the middle and then it goes all the way the other direction.
Exactly. I think that, we all talk about cycles. In a way, the pendulum is a better analogy. I use the pendulum to describe investor psychology for some reason.
Which is related, to
yes.
Market cycles.
Oh, very much so. And as I say in the book, there's no real reason why I think about the economy cyclically, but psychology as a pendulum, but that works for me.
Yeah, and you make the really interesting point that when times are good, and they could be legitimately good in the sense that unemployment is low, housing starts are high, the stock market is going up, the economy is doing well, private companies are making profits, everything seems good. But that's the time when there's many reasons to at least be skeptical. So for instance, if everything feels good, banks might decide, everything's so good and the unemployment's so low, we're going to start lending money to maybe people who otherwise we wouldn't have lent to, and we're going to lend and let them buy a house because we know historically housing rates are good, the economy's great, and it feels like it's going to continue forever. And so gradually what happens is worse and worse assets are being invested in precisely when times are good. Bad assets aren't being invested in when times are bad. You mentioned the reverse happens. When times are bad, nobody wants to lend because everyone's scared. This is the psychology point.
Right.
And so they'll only invest or lend to high quality assets. And so that's what begins the next boom, because high quality assets will go up and everybody will say, oh, things are good now. And more and more people start piling in.
Well, to use a crazy example, this could never happen, but let's say that things were going so well in the world that the bank said, we're going to lend money to people without asking whether they're employed and without asking to see their financial statements.
Well,
that could never happen.
You're in a comedy club, so you're making a joke, because that did happen.
That did happen. It was called the subprime crisis. Those things were called liar's loans. And how about this? You can go into a lender and you can say, I'd like to borrow money for buy a house. And he'll say, well, if you can document your employment and your assets, I'll lend to you at 7%. But if you can't document those things, you're going to have to pay 10. And you say, oh, I'll pay 10. What does that say? If you prefer to pay a higher rate of interest, it says for some reason you don't want to have to document your income. In other words, you're lying about your financials. And they say, okay, great, here's the money.
You mentioned, I mean, we can talk forever probably about the 2008 financial crisis, but it is worth mentioning because it's such an extreme of investor psychology. You know, there were several things that were happening. One is nobody thought people could default because the economy was going so great. It legitimately was great in like 2006.
And because there hadn't been a nationwide wave of defaults in over, let's say, 80 years.
Yeah.
So people tend to say, well, that it could never happen.
But then what happens is also interesting, which is that in these times of financial boom, investors, because they want to be actively involved and make even more money, they have financial innovations.
Right.
So they say, okay, well, we'll, you know, we'll put together a diversified assortment of these subprime loans. And because it's diversified, it'll have a high rating, so banks are allowed to invest in it. So these kinds of innovations that never existed before happen because there's so much eagerness to invest or spend or lend money, you have to have vehicles to do it with.
Exactly. And if you think about it, James, you can't innovate in bad times.
Right, because there's no money.
There's no money and there's no trust. And everybody's allergic to taking risk. You can only innovate in good times. And in good times, people are not so skeptical. They're not so demanding. They're not so careful in their analysis. They don't use conservative assumptions. They say, sure, we'll take a shot. Maybe that'll work. And that's why one of the things I say in the book is that the worst of loans are made in the best of times, because of this willingness to take a chance.
Right.
Hyman Minsky was an economist who said that stability is destabilizing.
Yeah, because and it's interesting because and I want to touch on one other aspect of that, which is that the laws also kind of change in the favor of putting more money to work in good times. So, but you have to be careful, like, not too many, and you pointed out in the book, but not too many people are aware that a huge chunk of what happened to Lehman Brothers and other banks specifically towards the end of 2008 was that the law changed about how you mark your assets. So people wanted more transparency in banks, which they had good intentions, but, and this is kind of hard to explain in a podcast, I won't bother trying, but many assets changed from mark to value to mark to market. And then Lehman Brothers collapsed.
Right. Everybody assumed more information is better, more transparency is better. So you should mark your assets to market every day. But the trouble is, if you're in a crisis, the banks are marking down their assets. The very act of the markdowns reduces the confidence in the banks and causes more markdowns, and it becomes a vicious circle.
And because of the increased leverage that the banks were allowed to use, I mean, I think it was with Lehman Brothers, just a 1% move in the prices of some of these, mortgage-backed derivatives was enough to collapse a trillion-dollar company almost.
Exactly.
And so on the one hand, on the flip side of that, then you take a period like, 2009. Okay, where you were heavily involved in, your firm was heavily involved in kind of the government's attempt to inject more money into the market. There is no lending happening.
Right.
And so almost by definition, any loans that do happen, these are the highest quality assets possible. And that's what's going to mark the next boom, because these are going to go up, which will give comfort to middle income investors, call them, or retail investors, which will then lead to eventually the pendulum will go too far again to the next boom, which is sort of what happened. But let me ask you this. 2008, you were spot on. You had called it. You had started calling it in 2006 that, hey, we need to start being skeptical. Things could be happening. In 2008, you raised $10 billion for your firm to invest in distressed assets before they were even distressed. It was very good foreshadowing. But at that point, things got so bad at the end of 08 and early 09 that it really required, maybe yes, maybe no, but it seemed to require government intervention to save the economy. Without that government intervention, would your raising $10 billion and perhaps putting it to work in 2008 would have looked foolish?
Well, what I would say is that at any point in time, and a lot of people don't appreciate this, there are lots of possible outcomes. And I use the analogy in the book repeatedly about drawing a ticket from a bowl, which has lots of lottery tickets in it. And the ticket that was pulled out of the bowl in 09 and then 10 and 11 and resulted in a massive recovery was a favorable ticket. And it didn't have to be that favorable. Now, I believe that we were, as you say, well-timed in raising that fund. And we aggressively put it to work in the fourth quarter of 08 when things were selling cheap because of the Lehman bankruptcy. I think we would have done okay, even if the recovery had not been as quick and as strong.
What would have happened if the government didn't take the steps it did, you know, inject, you know, $20 billion into the base capital of each bank, you know, open the credit window of the Fed much larger, you know, all these things that it doesn't normally do, it did to keep the banks open, to keep them lending potentially to high quality consumers and assets. Like, what do you think would have happened if the bailout didn't occur?
Well, that's a great question. One of my favorite books is called Fooled by Randomness by Nassim Nicholas Taleb.
I was going to bring it up because you could have been fooled by randomness in 2000. That's, you're the one who survived. Maybe the people who raised the $10 billion in 2007 didn't survive.
Right. And in fact, you know, maybe I've been a beneficiary. But the point is, Taleb talks about alternative histories, which I describe as the other things that reasonably probably could have happened but didn't. So you want to explore some of those. We're actually a little sore at Oaktree because the government precipitated such a strong and quick recovery that there were unusually few defaults and bankruptcies coming out of the global financial crisis at the bond issuer level. And normally, one of the reasons that our distressed debt funds historically have done well, as you described, was that in the low of the cycle, companies go bust. The creditors take them over. On low valuations, the valuation recovers. And even though we bought bonds and held bonds on the way down, we hold equity on the way up and we make a lot of money. But in this particular go-round, because of the recovery efforts, there were surprisingly few defaults in bankruptcy. And that fund was a good performing fund. But we think that if other tickets had been drawn from the bowl, it would have done even better.
You know, well, what do you mean? If other tickets had been drawn from the bowl, what could they have looked like?
Well, if the government response had been slower and not as skillful, the economy would have done worse. The recovery would have been deeper and longer. More companies would have defaulted and gone bankrupt. And we, as the bondholders, would have become the owners. And we would have made more money in the eventual recovery when it happened.
Yeah, it reminds me of, let's say, 2001, 2002. So Enron went bankrupt. It was a typical market cycle, as you described. So these sort of hybrid energy companies like Enron were hot in the late 90s and in 2000. Enron goes bankrupt because of corruption. But then every legitimate utility company, like just your standard guts utility company, they all started trading as if they were going to be the next Enron. So I imagine that was like because everyone was risk averse. Like, oh my gosh, everything is an Enron. I can't trust any utility company anymore. And I imagine that's the sort of opportunity where there's no government bailout and things recovered slowly. I imagine you did well.
Well, that's an extreme example, James, of a market cycle. You think about it, there's a secular trend, an upward trend that the economy is on and the markets are on, and the economy and the markets, you know, they're higher every decade than they were in the previous decade. There's an upward underlying direction. But we have fluctuations around the underlying trend, and I describe those fluctuations as excesses. So the point is, rather than everything selling at the happy medium of what something of every what everything is intrinsically worth, sometimes it sells for much more and sometimes for much less. The key is to figure out which is which. So you were talking about pre the Enron bankruptcy, they were all selling as if they were great. The truth is, some of them were okay, some of them were not so great, but some of them were terrific. But in a period of positive attitudes, they all sold as if they were great. And then Enron goes bankrupt. Now everybody says, oh, I don't trust any CEOs. I don't trust any financial statements. I don't trust Arthur Andersen. And by the way, and now they're all crap. So now, before, some of them were not so great. Some were okay and some were terrific. Now they're selling like they're all terrible. Values, prices vastly undershoot intrinsic value. That's a down cycle. And we should be able to profit from that if we can see it objectively and move on it unemotionally.
But and that was a case where, unlike 2009, the government wasn't buying all the debt of these energy companies. So you were able to go in right there and buy. And by the way, when it means to buy cheap debt, it means you're buying, you're taking over a loan that the company took out. And because it's been cheap, instead of their original loan, which might have been they've been paying 5% interest or 6% interest on to the bank or the investors, you're getting like 19 or 20% or more.
Well, the key step is that, let's say they borrowed $10 million from a bank, and we go in and we buy that loan for $4 million.
Right.
So we get the interest they promised to pay, but on a much lower cost, which gives us a much higher yield. And if they don't pay, generally speaking, in bankruptcy, the old owners are wiped out and the creditors become the new owners.
Right. So if there's real value there, backing exactly the loan, like in a house, for instance,
yes,
or in a utility company, you have you're a monopoly on providing the energy for, you know, 1,000 square miles or whatever. There's an asset there underneath.
Exactly.
So you benefit, you know, and just to put a little bit of math, just to explain to the listeners, somebody borrows a $10 million. Let's just hypothetically say they're paying 10% interest. Right. So they're paying $1 million a year. Now, everybody's afraid. And by the way, you constantly point out in the book and even in this podcast, it really is all related to psychology.
Right.
So investors are afraid. No one wants to touch this utility company anymore. So they'll only pay $4 million. It only costs $4 million for you to buy the debt. But the company still owes $1 million a year. So instead of paying 10% a year, they're paying 25% a year.
Exactly. As long as we get paid, we get a terrific yield.
And then the $4 million might go back up to $10 million.
Or
you take over the company.
Or it may go into default. We take over the company, and hopefully in the long run, it's worth even more.
So there's three things I want to point out first in the book. One is, I love your quote where, when you're looking at an investment asset, what part of the price of that asset is based on reality and what part is based on optimism? So as an example, if you were going to buy a house in, let's call it East Hampton by the ocean, which is a very attractive spot for many Manhattanites, there's a certain amount of optimism baked into the price. That's considered a very, you know, nice place to live. And if you were just a few miles south in West Hampton, it might not be as expensive. Even though it's the same house and the beach looks the same and the ocean's the same, there's a certain amount of optimism you're paying for, or
premium.
East-ish. Yeah, privilege you're paying for or whatever. Yes. So I like that quote because it could be applied to many aspects of life, even human psychology.
Well, investing well, it's not merely a matter of what you buy. The most important moving part is what you pay. You can buy a great asset, but if you overpay, you're not going to have success. You can buy a terrible asset, but if you buy it cheap enough, you could be a big winner. So the first step is to be able to value the asset and come up with something that we value investors call it the intrinsic value. The second step is to
which see, is a whole science to itself.
The whole science. And
there's many books on it.
Exactly. The second step is to take a look at how the current asset price comports or compares with that intrinsic value. We want to buy things for less than they're worth. So the real question is, what causes assets to sell for more than they're worth or less than they're worth? Largely the cycle. And what causes the cycle? Largely emotion or optimism. I say in the book that if I want to buy an asset, what I want to know is how much optimism is baked into the price. And in short, you don't want to buy when everybody's optimistic, because the chances are that that optimism will have elevated the price and the price will exceed the intrinsic value. In other words, a losing investment. You want to buy when nobody's optimistic. And if there's little optimism in the price, chances are you're getting a bargain. So understanding what's going on and where we stand in that process is largely a matter of understanding the cycles.
So how would you go about, how do you personally go about determining, hey, there's a lot of optimism in this, baked into the price of this optimism, of this asset? Okay, like you're, let's say you're thinking of buying Apple stock and you decide, you know what, it's not worth $1 trillion. Maybe it's worth 600 billion. Would you say then the other 400 billion is because, oh, kids love their iPhones, so their dads and moms are, you know, excited about owning the stock that their kids are buying the phones, and there's optimism in there.
Exactly. What I try to do and try to explain in the book, and what I think is the skill that I'd like people to develop, is the ability to look at the market and do what I call take its temperature. And understand, is it a hot market or a cold market? Are people optimistic or pessimistic? Are they greedy or are they fearful? Are they risk tolerant or risk averse? Are they believing or are they skeptical? If people are optimistic and greedy and risk tolerant and believing, then prices will, everything else being equal, be higher than they should be. We want to see that, understand what it means, and act accordingly, which is to take risk off.
But
meaning either own fewer assets or own safer assets. You don't have to get out of the market. You could shift from risky assets to safer assets when you feel that the market is a risky place. Look at today. I don't think things are so bad that people should get out of the market, but they can cut their risk by owning safer assets rather than more aggressive assets. On the other hand, when people are pessimistic and fearful and risk averse and skeptical, everything else being equal, take those things together, prices will be lower and perhaps lower than they should be. And when prices are lower than intrinsic value and lower than they should be, that's the time to become more aggressive. Either put more cash into the market or switch from safe assets to aggressive risky assets. It all comes from understanding where we stand. That is the skill that I wanted to help people develop.
And I think this book does a great, you give so many examples and go through history and describe your philosophy in so many things. Like I love when you point out how contrarianism doesn't necessarily mean being negative. You know, we could be in a down market and a contrarian would say, hey, time to buy.
But exactly.
It's usually not, that's not usually called contrarian investing, because people usually don't like buyers who are buying in a bad market.
Right.
People usually make fun of them. Oh, you're stupid. The world's falling apart. It's different than people who don't buy if you don't buy in a good market, it said you're missing out. But if you do buy in a bad market, you're like an idiot.
Well,
that's what they call
worse,
you
know, the distressed debt funds that we've run used to be called vulture funds. And people would say, oh, you're a vulture. Why is trying to buy when prices are low vulture activity. And yet, you know, it's these names, if they scare others off, we like that. We like to have the field to ourselves.
Or it's like Warren Buffett says, when he goes to the grocery store, he wants to pay less for the hamburger, not, he doesn't want to pay when the hamburgers were all exactly. on a premium to what they were the day before.
Well, that's another aspect of the temperature of the market. You know, you buy a stock at 60, it goes to 80. Most people say, hey, I think I'm onto something here. I'm going to get more. It goes to 100. They say, now I'm sure I'm right. I'm going to double up. But if you buy a stock at 40 and at 60 and it goes to 40, most people say, well, I'm not sure of my thesis. Maybe I should lighten up. And if it goes to 20, they say, I'm going to get out before it goes to zero. In other words, they want to own more when the price is high and less when the price is low. And that's the opposite of what Buffett's talking about. You know, he says, I like hamburgers. I eat more hamburgers when they're on sale. The stores are crowded when things are on sale. Only in the investment markets do people want to hold less the lower the price goes.
You know, we talked in the very beginning, we started off, I introduced you by what you do, by the book, and by your net worth. And you mentioned that, you know, often you don't like to be measured that way, which I understand. But to some extent, having some money allows you to take off the table fear of financial insecurity. So if there's 100 million investors in the United States, 99 million of them or more are scared when the markets are down, legitimately scared, because as you know, and you have the quote in this book, the famous quote, the markets could stay rational or irrational longer than you can stay liquid or whatever.
Solvent.
So you could go bankrupt pouring money in during bad markets if the badness continues.
Exactly.
Because here's me playing the devil's advocate to what you're saying. It's one thing to say, okay, maybe everybody's feeling a little too exuberant, or maybe everyone's feeling a little too pessimistic. But as we know, Greenspan thought we were exuberant in whenever it was, 1996, 1997, things stayed exuberant for another 3 years. A lot of hedge funds that were shorting went out of business between 1997 and 2000.
Well, that's what's endemic to the investment business. There, one of my favorite sayings is that being too far ahead of your time is indistinguishable from being wrong. In 96, Greenspan said, we are beginning to see signs of irrational exuberance. Now, he was right, but he was 4 years too early, and it didn't feel like right in the meantime. As you say, a lot of people left the market as a result of the 90s because either they were short and got carried out, or they were afraid, failed to participate in the boom, and their clients deserted them. So, you know, in the investing business, we sometimes know what's going to happen. We never know when. We should never act with extreme conviction. The world, if you're a Taleb reader, fooled by randomness, you know the world is too uncertain to permit certainty. Mark Twain, I think, said it best. He said, it's not what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for certain that just ain't true. And, you know, if you admit to uncertainty, you're unlikely to get carried out.
So let's extrapolate that to something outside the market, like something in your personal life, say, because the same rule applies. Like, you even talk about it. Success breeds a certain relaxation of your decision-making.
Exactly. Well, you know, our wives always claim that men are not good at asking directions. And let's say after our interview today, I want to drive from New York to Boston. Now, if I am appropriately humble about my knowledge of the geography, I will get a map, ask directions, turn on the GPS, and drive slowly enough so that I don't make wrong turns. But if I'm cocksure that I know the way, I will not get a map or ask directions or turn on the GPS. I'll drive really fast. I'll probably go right by my exit and I'll get lost, all because I thought I knew something that I didn't. So that is one of the things to watch out for.
And so this is almost what you refer to as the second level thinking, like understanding what you're understanding.
Exactly.
And in general, understanding that you probably don't know as much as you think you do.
Well, that's one of the important things. But I like your phraseology, understanding your understanding. The matter of second level thinking is very important. We talked before about, I think your example was Apple. Great company. Most people who haven't thought about it enough, who haven't read what I've written, might say, great company, we should buy the stock. But other people who think more deeply might say, it's a great company, but it's not as great as everybody thinks, so it's probably overpriced, we should sell the stock. You have to, we used to call it reverse psychology when we were kids. But you have to, if you want, investing is a competitive game. You are in there trying to find the cheap assets, and so is everybody else. You are in there trying to hold more at the right time and less at the wrong time, and so is everybody else. So to some extent, you have to learn to think different from others and better. Thinking different is not enough if it's worse. It has to be different and better. And that is the concept that enables you to find the errors that others are making. And when everybody says it's a great company, we should buy it, that thinking is not disciplined by the issue of price. And price gets carried too far. And there are very few assets that are so good that they can't become overpriced and lethal. That's what the book is all about, helping people develop this skill to do.
I mean, and you bring up so many good examples, but the foremost being everybody thought real estate is safe because sure. They could just come and take your house.
Right.
So you're not going to default on it. And the default system, I mean, we saw many big hedge funds explode because they believed the ratings that, oh, this is safe. It's just a diverse portfolio sure. of housing loans. But again, that's why, yes, it's you want to be cautious when everyone's happy. You want to be a skeptical when everyone says the world's ending and act accordingly. But I think another important principle you have is, and this is even related to your fictional trip to Boston, you need to stay in the game. And maybe explain that a little further, because that's kind of a motto of your business.
Well, that's another of the important sayings in the investment business. Never forget about the man who was 6 foot tall, who drowned crossing the stream that was 5 feet deep on average.
I never heard that story.
Well, the point is, to be a successful investor, at minimum, you have to survive. Surviving on the good days is not the issue. You have to be able to survive the bad days. The idea of surviving on average is not sufficient. You have to be able to survive on the worst days. So you have to adjust your portfolio so as to limit the risk so that you can survive on the worst of days. If you get liquidated, carried out, if you don't have the conviction and you give up on the bad days, then by definition, you don't participate in the subsequent recovery, the cardinal sin of investing.
So, I mean, on any given day, you have an example in the book where a potential investor asked you, well, what if there's this many defaults? And you said, that's not happened in any 1 year ever. And they say, but what if it does happen? And then you say, well, it's not happened in 1 year. It's not happened in the history of the world. It's not happened in this, that. And they kept saying, but what if it does happen? And you thought that you made the interesting point that it's okay to be skeptical in the worst of times and not be overly negative in the worst of times. But what's a scenario where your firm with $120 billion under management, diversified across the world, across different investment assets, what would cause you to shudder and have a sleepless night? Other than like a nuclear war, like that.
Well, look, you go back to fourth quarter of 2008, Lehman bankruptcy, You know, remember, we lost Merrill Lynch. We lost Bear Stearns. We lost Lehman Brothers, Wachovia Bank, Washington Mutual. And everybody said, well, you know, Morgan Stanley's next. And after that, they're going to tee up Goldman Sachs. They're all going under. It's a downward spiral. It can't be arrested. We're going to have the meltdown of the financial institutions. What I said at the time was, if you're not scared, you don't understand what's going on. It was scary times. That scenario could not be discounted. First of all, there's no way to prove anything about the future. We were going through experiences that had never occurred before. So there was absolutely no way to say, no, that's impossible. That's not going to happen. But what you could say is, I don't think it's going to happen. We've never had anything like that before. I think that people are ignoring the recovery potential of the economy and the markets. And by the way, we can buy assets so cheaply today that we're probably covered, even if the recovery is delayed and imperfect.
Like even if, I mean, there was serious potential for 19 of the top 20 banks, say, to go out of business just because of, you know, they were highly leveraged, there was mark to market. But you're saying McDonald's still would have served hamburgers and people still would have had jobs at Target and McDonald's and Walmart, and the economy would somehow slowly but surely come back, and there would be all these opportunities, like maybe cheap banks that you could buy or whatever.
Exactly. And so what I said in reaction to the experience that you described with that person who could not be satisfied with, who could not imagine an assumption that was suitably negative, what I realized was that it is our job as investors to be skeptical. If we believe all the stories we hear, then by definition, we can't be a second-level thinker. We can't think differently and better. We have to disbelieve the common account. But that usually means, and everybody says, sure, I understand that. When you hear the Madoff claims, your job is, you know, we've gone up for 30 years in a row. We've returned between 9 and 11% every year for 30 years in a row. We never had a down month. You had to say, that's too good to be true. Everybody knows that. Oh, yes, well, but yes, you must say it's too good to be true. And what I had kind of an epiphany there at the lows of October 08 after I had the experience with that pension fund manager, because what I realized is that when optimism is excessive, skepticism consists of saying that's too good to be true. But when optimism is in too short supply, skepticism consists of saying, no, that's too bad to be true. And very few people ever do that.
It's hard because, again, like if the average person just got fired from his job and they say, well, at least I have my stock market portfolio, and then they get their statement and like, oh my gosh, I don't have my stock market portfolio anymore. It just went down by 70%. They're scared.
Yes.
And then their investor buddy says, hey, but now's the time, mortgage the house and put everything into the stock market. They're like, I'm not going to do that. I just lost 70%. Like my experience is that's a bad strategy.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the most important chapters in the book is the one on attitudes towards risk. When things are going great, what do people say? Risk is my friend. The more risk I take, the more money I make. And by the way, I can't see anything to be worried about. But in the bad times that you just described, what do they say? Risk is just another way to lose money. I don't care if I make a penny in the market again. I just don't want to lose anymore. Get me out at any price. Those are the attitudes that create bottoms.
So let's just say there's a quantifiable way to measure the optimism and pessimism. We could probably come up with a variety.
Well, I describe some techniques in the book under what I call the poor man's guide to market assessment.
Yeah, and I think, again, you know, there's an opportunity for things to be too optimistic for too long and too pessimistic for too long. And so that's the challenge then is, okay, things are optimistic or things are pessimistic, but I can't predict when the pendulum will stop swinging. what's the next level of this second level thinking where I can still stay in the game but participate in what I think is too much of a swing in one direction or the other?
Well, it's a great question, James, and there's no easy answer. Because as I said before, we may know what's going to happen or suspect, but we never know when. So the tough times that we want to take advantage of, well, if I put all my money in today and the market turns next week, it's going to be fabulous. But what if it continues down for another month, 6 months, year, 2 years? We have to arrange our financial affairs so that we can survive. And we this introduces one of the key conundrums, because we have to be able to survive on the worst day, but we can't quantify how bad the worst day can be. Now, if you said to me, you know, if you hired Oak Tree to run some of your money, and you said, okay, Howard, here's my dough, but I had a terrible time in 08, couldn't sleep, I was close to bankruptcy, I never want to get there again. I want you to always be prepared to face a rerun of 08. We'd be paralyzed. You can't prepare every day for the worst case, because you won't be able to take action.
Right. And you know, as you mentioned, you know, Mark, you're full of Mark Twain quotes. You know, the market often doesn't repeat, or history often doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. And so there might not be another situation so fast like 2006, which felt great, followed immediately by 2008, which was the worst year of everybody's life. Like right now, we're in this extended bull run. So people use basic statistics to say, okay, this bull run has gone on for too long. But at the same time, most people I know are actually saying this bull run's gone on for too long. So there's actually not that much optimism.
Exactly.
It's kind of a confusing market.
Yes. Well, you know, you're right. I think that one of the best things this market has going for it is that there is no euphoria or exuberance. You don't see the talking heads on TV saying, this is the last best chance to get into the market before it takes off for the moon. Last time, around 99, there was a book published called Dow 36,000, you may recall, which basically implied that the Dow was going to triple the next day because stocks were too cheap. And there has not been a reprint of Dow 36,000. So you're right. Investors are not overly optimistic. However, there's a catch. What I say is that they are not thinking bullish, but they're acting bullish. And because the yields on money market and treasuries and high-grade bonds are so low, and the expectations for stocks are not so high either, investors have had to push out the risk curve in order to earn a good return in a low return world. So most people have had to do riskier things than they have ever done in order to get a decent return. And when people behave in a risky manner, they make the market a risky place.
So like, what's an example of a riskier thing you've seen lately?
Well, I think that, you know, I was lucky to start Citibank's high yield bond fund 40 years ago when high yield bonds were paying 12%. And most people wouldn't buy them because they said, young man, that's disreputable. It's unseemly. I'm sure you can make money that way, but it wouldn't be right. Nowadays, almost everybody's buying high yield bonds at 6%. Because they need the yield. And that's true of leveraged loans. It's true of private lending, private credit. It's true of private equity and venture capital. Everybody is intoxicated by the higher returns that have been reported recently in the boom and turned off by the lower returns offered by safe assets.
So I'm going to play a slight devil's advocate. You know, yields, of course, on treasury, on market-related bonds are often low, not just because of optimism, but because they're slightly higher than government bonds. And government bonds have been kept artificially low
right.
since 2009 because they're afraid of a crisis again. But often government interest rates are low to match inflation. And they go up to sort of combat inflation. So my argument is, do we need a different definition of inflation? Typically, we take a basket of goods and we look at the prices going up or down. We forget about the fact that right now I have a supercomputer from 1980 in my pocket. So there's kind of a deep productivity and technology and innovation has created a certain massive deflation.
Yeah, measuring inflation is very difficult. On the one hand, it's very hard to capture in the statistic the improvement in products that you describe. Every day, let's say that every day the cost of the goods we buy is unchanged, but every day they get better. That means that really we have negative inflation because the cost right. of a the cost of a unit
in a
of
good
goodness,
way, not
yes.
in the Warren Buffett
right.
scary way,
right?
Because not in the Great
right.
Depression
right.
deflation
right.
way, but actually it's a good thing for society.
But on the other hand, the government tells everybody that we don't have much inflation today. It's running about 2%, which is barely above zero. And yet, I don't think many people feel that. I think many people feel that the cost of living is rising and that they're having trouble keeping up with it. So I'm one who happens to believe that that's an imperfect statistic.
So, yeah, so it's interesting. So what do you think is happening there? Like, why does everybody feel like it's a little tighter and yet we do have the deflation properties of innovation, and the government's not even saying in the traditional way there's much inflation. What's going on?
You know, I'm just not enough of an economist to be able to suss that out.
Okay, but that's interesting. That's information in and of itself, that you don't really need to be an economist to understand how to identify and deal with different market conditions.
I'd rather be a psychologist. You know, if when you read the book, if you weighed it out, you would find that there's much more weight on understanding psychology and people's attitudes towards risk and where that stands today than in parsing out the economy.
And I think also there's an idea, again, with this kind of almost meditative way of looking at your own thoughts or society's thoughts. There's this idea that runs through the book, which is that I need to understand that people are often irrational, including me, so and make decisions accordingly, and that helps me stay in the game as well.
Exactly. You know, you talk to economists, they talk about something called economic man, somebody who is objective and rational and makes intelligent, maximizing decisions. And that's the way things should run. But then you look at people and you see that they are emotional and they are subject to psychological swings and they don't often do what that objective emotional man would do. It is because people are not hardwired to be unemotional that we have a lot of the cyclicality that we do. I mean, look at it this way. The value of stocks seems to go up 9, 10% a year. The return in the stock market has averaged 9 or 10 for the last almost 90 years since the statistics have been computed. And yet, it almost never returns 8, 9, 10, 11, or 12. Usually it's up big or down. Why is that? Why is the normal experience so different from what the average return should be? And the answer is emotion. It goes from too hot to too cold. Too much optimism, too little optimism. And wouldn't you like to be able to catch that and profit from it? That's what the book's all about.
Yeah, and so I have two more points on that, and then I know you have to get going, but I first want to mention this is a great book for a lot of reasons. Mastering the Market Cycle, Getting the Odds on Your Side by Howard Marks. First, I just enjoy the way you explain investing and risk and kind of recent historical booms and busts. You really help the layman understand, but not talking down to them. It's a very sophisticated book, but it's understandable. It's well done, in other words.
Thank
so
you, James.
So it's a great book to read for understanding the market. And I do think there's practical aspects one can take of it, even by just absorbing the wisdom and the philosophy and then some of the very practical things you say and the examples you use. I wanted to ask you though, like, you seem like such a level-headed person. You've had a consistent business for 23 years, which is, as you know, very hard to do. You've been in this industry since when?
68.
So it's 1968, it's 2018, 50 years. So, you know, they say it takes 10,000 hours to be the best in the world. Something you've put in a good 50,000 hours to clearly be, you know, to earn your position in the hierarchy of great investors. What advice did your mom and dad give you when you were a kid to make you this way?
Well, it really didn't come from my mom and dad. I was lucky. My parents were perfectly supportive, but not, they didn't talk to me about investments. I wasn't one of those kids who was,
I'm not talking about investments.
Yes.
I'm talking about you being so level-headed and consistent. How long have you been working with Bruce Karsh, your partner?
31 years.
31 years. Imagine working
never
with
a partner. Never had an argument. Never had a serious disagreement.
Okay, I have an argument with my girlfriend every other week. Like, how do you do it? Someone gave you advice at some point that has helped you.
Well, you know, I think that a certain amount of humility was inculcated in me, you know, and I don't think I ever grew up cocky, and Bruce too. And so each of us is open to the other's ideas. When we have an intellectual discussion, neither of us puts a great emphasis on winning. We want to get to the right answer. You know, we have enormous respect for each other, which I think is the key. And when he says something, a position different from mine, my first reaction is to say, no, how can I diffuse that? How can I beat that? How can I prove he's wrong? My first reaction is to say, hey, what can I get from that? What can I take away? Is he right? Maybe he's right and I was wrong. And, you know, where that comes from, I can't really tell you. But I think to achieve great things, I think that an important property, it's a funny thing, it's really a conundrum, because you have to have the courage of your convictions. You have to have confidence in the things you say. You have to be strong enough to act, and of course, hopefully have it be based on a solid foundation. But at the same time, I think I'm a big believer in intellectual humility, which means saying, number one, I could be wrong. Number two, he could be right. And you have to have that mix of confidence with intellectual humility. It sounds like a contradiction in terms, but, you know, for me, for Bruce, for Warren Buffett dealing with Charlie Munger, et cetera, it is really the secret to success. And also, as you point out, a great partnership is the secret to happiness.
I mean, look at, like, you know, Microsoft for many years was Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer, Google, Larry Page, Sergey Brin, you know, many great companies, even Apple, you know, in the second part of its era was Steve Jobs, Tim Cook, and he had a good team of people. It seems no man is self-made, is what we've learned here on many of these podcasts, is that it always requires a team. No one can do it on their own.
Well, you know, President Obama got into trouble for saying something like, you know, if you had a success, you didn't do that. What he meant was, if you had a success, you didn't do that alone. You had help. Somebody like me got a good education, a loving home, good partner, mentors early, and also luck. And I'm a great believer in luck. And there are deserving people who don't get ahead because they weren't lucky. And there are less deserving people who do get ahead because they're enormously lucky. I believe in luck. I don't believe that we automatically get our due, our just desserts.
But there is some component that one can create their luck.
Like, and that's, like, and I that's will the take third
a
guess, point.
And I will say you read quite a bit.
Yes, that's
like
right.
How many books a month do you read?
I'd say two or three. I'm a slow reader.
What's like the last couple of books?
Factfulness.
By Hans Rosling, great book.
And Thinking in Bets by Annie Duke.
She's been on the podcast.
Yes. So, you know, those are some examples. And they are both enlightening, but also interesting.
So again, Mastering the Market Cycle by Howard Marks. I've been a fan and a follower of your writings for so long. It's such a pleasure to be able to talk to you about investing on this podcast. I wish we could talk for 5 hours more. I have a ton more questions, but I'll tell you one little story.
Sure.
And you'll say thank you to me at the end of that story, at the end of this story. It's not going to be a humble story. But in 2009, I was living on 15 Broad Street, directly across the street from New York Stock Exchange. Everyone was depressed every day. Like, I would just see, I would wake up at 9:30, I'd walk outside, I'd see the traders were just walking, looking at the ground while they were walking into the exchange. No one was happy, everyone was depressed, and the markets kept going down. It was the worst ever. I mean, March 2009 was worse in the market levels than even in 2008. So I went to the local drugstore and I bought a ton of chocolates. Chocolates have oxytocin, trigger oxytocin neurochemicals, which increase risk-taking behavior. And I just simply handed out chocolates to every trader walking into the New York Stock Exchange. March 9th, 2009, which is the absolute low of the market. Boom, you're welcome. I saved the world economy.
Thank you very much, James. And thank you for having me here today.
Thank you, Howard. I really appreciate it.